Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking in the Rain. I'm your host, Saira Unju, and today I have with me artist Johnny Trin. He's also the artistic director of Vancouver Poetry House, who is hosting the 14th Versus Festival of Words here in Vancouver until April 27th. Johnny and I had a lovely conversation. We got into community, listening, poetry, culture. It was genuinely really interesting, and I cried a little. So I hope you enjoy. And something that I couldn't get into was his first spoken word EP, hashtag Undeniable, that was released in 2017. Poetry by Johnny and music by Noah Walker, which if you're interested in Johnny's work, you can check it out. And I hope you enjoy. Welcome. Thank you for joining me. So do you want to start with a little bit of introduction to get the, audience to know you more, how long you've been writing poetry for? When did you get into spoken word specifically? And how has your interests in creating art evolved over time?
Hey there, hey everybody. My name is Johnny D. Trin. I am a interdisciplinary community engaged artist with a primary practice right now in spoken word, though I also really engage in culinary art and storytelling. I am also the artistic director for the Vancouver Poetry House Society, and we are the stewards of the Versus Festival of Words and the upcoming Canadian Individual Poetry Slam. So it's a very busy, exciting time, and I love that this question's about, going back to my roots and saying how I got started as an artist. I would say that I've always been writing. I started writing poetry as early as I can remember, was around when I was 12, but I never thought much of it. I was a very academic student, a very typical and stereotypical upbringing as an Asian, Canadian, whatever that means, in terms of like aiming towards a career in medicine or science or something. And I just couldn't shake off the artist need. So when I got to university, I tried the sciences, it didn't work out, and I ended up going into theater and drama. That didn't really work out, so I went to music theater school and then graduated there and then said, oh, there's not much work happening for me right now, so I went back to school, finished my BA, and so I had these two pieces of paper that said I could be a performer or that I was qualified in some way, and I was talented and engaging, but there were no roles for me out there in the film and television world or the theater world really at the time. And it's hard for a lot of Asian gendered folks at the time. This is long before Crazy Rich Asians, and they just had Joe the Club and Double Happiness, so few and far between. But during this time when I was at university, I was introduced to Deaf Poetry Jam, and as I said, it kind of harkened back to my early days of writing poetry, and it felt really true. I remember going to this play reading by an incredible Canadian artist, Janet Sears, and she was doing a reading of her play Harlem Duet. And it is a retelling and a reimagining of Othello from the gaze of Billy Cymbeline, who was Othello's first wife. And it really leaned into this duality and tension of interracial relationships, racial divides. And I was so taken aback because even though this story was very rooted in Black culture and identity, there were things that I could relate to. So I spoke with her after, and she goes, you need to tell your story. And that's when I started to like write poetry that was really reflective of my work. And it did well for what it was. And I ended up writing a play based around like poetry, really talking about different narratives and different tensions that I was living with and barriers I was living with. And that got me to my master's, my MFA program at the University of Regina in Treaty 4 territory. And while I was there, my friend said, hey, my roommate's doing this poetry thing. You want to check it out? I'm like, oh, sure, I'll check it out. I went there and I read a bit of my play. It was really well received. I was shocked. And I found that, wow, people want to hear what I have to say about my own story. Went to the poetry slam, started competing, and I did well. I was winning a fair bit. And that got me onto my first poetry slam team that then immediately took me to my first nationals. So that's a really fun story. I was cast in my very first equity show. It was for A Man of Fish at Persephone Theater, under the writing, amazing writing of Donna Michelle St. Bernard, directed by Philip Adams. I close the show. I drive white knuckle down the highway of Saskatchewan in the dead winter to get to the airport to go to Montreal for my first nationals, where I met so many of my heroes and people that I kept moved to work with today. And it was pretty incredible. Anyway, that's a long story of the rest is sort of history, I suppose. I was competing a lot in the national team scene. And then 2016 found me competing at my very first Canadian Individual Poetry Slam. And from there, I kind of alternated from competing and then being the tournament director back and forth to finally becoming the artistic director for the organization. And it's been a long journey, but a joy because I love this practice. I love this craft. I want to add here, it's really important to add here that spoken word is not limited to slam. That just happened to be a common avenue that people take to pursue their work. For me, and to wrap up this part of the story, is that I'm not interested in competition. The thing that makes the magic happen is the connecting with other artists and sharing work and sharing skills. My actual research practice is in autoethnographic performance. And that's really related to autobiographical performance, which is really related to spoken word and slam and whatnot, because we're telling our own stories. But I'm really interested in the cultural significance behind it. And that's where the food comes in. A lot of folks, especially folks who are racialized or from away, identify with food and their culture's deeply tied into that. But what does it mean for many of us who are not from here to bring food across the oceans to here to impact the indigenous food systems here? Whose stories are we taking away? How do we engage in each other? How do we work together? And that's really important to me. And so from there, I've been doing a lot of work around food and storytelling and relating to that. My project I'm working on right now is called Quiet Kitchen. When so many of us tie our relationships with food and identity with food, and we get that knowledge given to us by our ancestors, by grandmas, parents, aunties, uncles, whoever, but then that relationship is strained, or we move, or people die, people get COVID, people get dementia. So what happens when the kitchen is quiet? How do we find our identity and culture? So that's my big project that I've been working on for the last year and a bit, called Quiet Kitchen.
That, oh, I'm not from here either. Well, I mean, I'm Turkish. I moved here 7 years ago. And what you said about, food being such a big part of culture and us bringing it here. And the last thing you mentioned about, when you lose people, when the kitchen's quiet, I'm so sorry, I'm about to cry.
That's okay. It's great. It makes it real. It's all good.
I lost my grandma almost 2 years ago, and her food made me so happy. And going back home and not being able to eat it. Oh, oh my God. See, this is why I love art. It makes you feel things. I
I'm
wasn't
really
expecting to cry at 10 a.m. in the morning.
hey, it's sometimes I cry at random times throughout the day because life is lifing really hard. Right now, personally, as an art practice, I've been working at the Moberly Arts and Cultural Center, and I've run several food residencies there. And there's a very strong, diverse community, a lot of Punjabi elders and seniors there. But it's a mixed bag. But what we do is that we gather, and then I find a knowledge keeper, either a professional chef or an auntie or one of the participants, to teach something that is kind of universal. Rather, they teach something that's relevant to them, and we discover how it is universal, like dumplings or like soup or stews or fruit or salad, things like we can, all share in. And I'm so glad that what I said in my work is resonating, because that's a common story that comes up, and that's the thing, right? Where you go home, wherever home is, and you learn the recipe and you make it, but it's never quite the same. It's just not like, and I mean, I definitely love to cook, and I cook. It's weird. I cook artistically for a lot of people, I suppose, as part of my practice. I wouldn't call myself a professional in any way, and it's good. My food is good. I can cook well, right? But it's that moment of like, there's something. Why did my mom make it so much better? Like, what did she do differently? I did the exact same thing. What is it, right? And that comes with like time and experience and trust, I suppose.
Yeah, I hope in the future I get to, gain that experience and that, I don't know, knowledge, I guess, that life and that makes your food taste just different from anyone else's food. Yeah, that's incredible. Your interest in culinary arts, did it start through this and it's kind of evolved into what it is, or were you always interested in food and the stories it tells, and that's kind of created this project for you?
I think that I've always been interested in food because of how experiential it is and how multisensory it is. I've been very lucky in that both of my parents work professionally to various degrees in food, to the point where they never let me in the kitchen in terms of like, it's funny. So when I was a toddler and when I was very, very young, there were times when they would take me to the restaurant with them, the restaurants they worked at with them, and I had to work and do things. Or I remember them telling me that when I was like 4 or 5, I made the best rice, and I'd cook and do that stuff. But then as I got older and school was getting more intense, I cooked less. I wasn't allowed in the kitchen because I was a messy cook or whatever else. But for me, it was just having so much diverse food and at such a high level, like it's really good, that I was always shocked when I went elsewhere. I'm like, oh, this doesn't taste as good as home, you know? But it really wasn't, you know, and that's that in that way. And I think that I also was really intensely engaged with food because in some ways it's m even more universal. When we think about senses and language and accessibility, and translations and things like that, that can be really hard, right? Like it causes challenges. It's the crux of many disagreements. But then, like we all gotta eat, and we all experience different flavors. And also, when you learn about the ethnography, the anthropology of the food. In my early research, I did a lot of reading of like Anthony Bourdain's work. And that's a great example of just understanding why do we ferment food this way? Why does this culture do it this way? You know, why does this culture eat nose to tail? Everything goes, you know, like it's just learning about how those feed into the story really impacts the depth of the understanding of it. So yeah, that's mainly it. I think that food's also been a great source of conflict resolution. I remember seeing this interview with the chef, Tom Colicchio, who's the head judge chef for Top Chef, and he runs a lot of work in terms of food security in America. And in his research, he talks about how if we look at the big issues facing America, whether it's poverty, housing insecurity, crime, even substance use, like all the things, education, you know, a core thing is if we fix the food systems, that would solve a lot of the problems. And so I really am inspired by those realities, and I want to use art and poetry and spoken word to yet find another factor, another facet of that work. A lot of my peers and friends do different aspects of similar things, right? But instead of food, they look at climate change and how like art and storytelling can affect and improve that, right? I think of Alessandra Nacarado and her work on bees and storytelling. It's really powerful.
Yeah, I agree. And your work being so community focused, I think it makes a lot of sense that you focus on food, and as we talked about it, they're so intertwined. And talking about community, I saw your TED Talk, which is titled Building Community Through Listening. And there's this quote. I mean, the whole TED Talk is very quotable. But in the beginning, you say, when speaking becomes noise and ignorance becomes silence, we're left with the disconnection without a sense of community. Community happens when we feel heard and willingly listened. So, who do you listen to? Who do you silence? And can you listen even when it's uncomfortable? Well, these are, first of all, great questions and a great point. And in your, I guess, years of creating art, and as you evolve as an artist, as you focus on communities, that changes over time too. Who you listen to in this sense, has that changed over the years? And genuine question, how do you listen? even when it's uncomfortable?
That's an amazing question. I always feel strange when someone quotes back things I've said to me, and I love it because it just makes me think. On a side tangent, one of the organizations that I started, I'm the founder of Stage to Page Performance Society, and the goal there is to help, in particular, spoken word artists, but artists in general, to expand their practice. And for a lot of spoken word artists, we write for ourselves, we notate for ourselves to perform the way we want to. But a natural progression that's common, but not necessary, but common, is to publish a book. And to do that, you're now translating your work into another medium, technically, for someone else to read, to hear those words back. And it's been an amazing organization, an amazing project that I've developed, and this methodology. And it's just always really nice to like hear that back and make me think. And that's how I listen. I have to like take a pause and process and think about what's drawing in my spirit. To speak deeply about what we talked about before leading to this question, a lot of it stems from loneliness. We are so isolated, and we know the COVID-19 pandemic that is still affecting the world really exacerbated that for many of us, for all of us. And so I'm drawn, and I listen to folks who resist, who offer ourselves to loneliness. There are a lot of really powerful and important voices out there that don't invite people in. They are there to say, you do this wrong, be better. There are those people out there who are really important, saying really important things that are very much calls to action and edicts and say, you're doing this wrong, you're doing this right, you need to do this better. And that's all so important. But I always feel like we get that so much in life in any way. And so I'm really invited to what I really resonate with are people who just invite people to gather where there isn't always an agenda. I live with so many agendas and goals and administrative leadership things I have to do. So it's nice just to sit and listen. And I think that there are people who are really poignant in doing that. I think of artists like Brennan Wint, Gillian Christmas, Hari Alluri, whose work really invites an intimacy that helps you to feel safe enough to explore in that space. And I think that's really, really powerful. So how do I listen? I try to stop talking. It doesn't always work. I try to question what I'm hearing and who is speaking. I try to think about the context and where they're speaking and where they might be at that moment. You know, in our community, we have so much anger because that's what we do. Poets get to be angry. We get to say what is wrong and what is mad about the world. And so when working with communities like that, we have to listen and know that if all we've ever known is how to yell, why would I speak any different to you right now? And that's okay. So yell, and let's see if we can find a moment to speak differently. Or find a way to speak together differently, listen together differently. And that was a big core of my TED Talk. I was, again, an artist in residence at what was formerly known as the John Howard Society, now known as Connective. And their work really supported the transitions of people coming in and out of the criminal justice system. And as this organization grew over time and evolved, they recognized that the criminal justice system is deeply tied in with neurodivergence, housing insecurity, food insecurity, substance use, trauma. And whenever these communities gather, which are very prevalent in any marginalized space and within the spoken word community as well, the neighbors get nervous. Ooh, what's happening to my land value? Oh, they're bringing in violence and crime and drugs and blah, 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 all these stereotypes. And if we just took pause and gathered, we'd realize, no, we're just trying to survive.
Yeah, we are all just trying to survive. And I think, well, you raised some really good points throughout all of that. And something I've noticed in both your performances that I've seen online and your TED Talk while we're talking right now, you make me think it's just like more than anyone I've spoken to, I think. You have some really interesting thoughts.
Yeah, thank you.
And I love that. And so I have so many like things that come up and I don't know which one to ask. But I think first one is you mentioned how isolated we are. And as someone, because you know how Western cultures usually tend to be more individualistic, whereas Eastern cultures are more community-based. As someone who I guess you have kind of both. You have this unique, well, unique for me. I guess there are more people in Canada and the United States who grew up with both cultures. But as someone who grew up, well, you grew up in Canada, right?
Yes.
Yeah, you grew up in a Canada in an Asian family. That's kind of you have the individualistic culture where you're living, where you're growing up, but you also have the collectivist culture within you, within your family. Have you seen a clash between those two throughout your life? And I guess has that affected you?
Absolutely. I think another amazing, just dear friend and teacher of the universe is Kai Ching Tom. And if you get a chance to interview Kai Ching, she's incredible. And especially her, in particular, her book, I Hope We Choose Love. You know, it's in many ways, she is like the supreme embodiment of compassion. I am a direct result of what you just said. I had this quote that I came up with and it's been coined to me. It says, it takes a community to build an artist, whether we resist against it or nurtured by it. And, you know, trying to be an artist in a family that re an immigrant family that really wanted me to become a doctor was so much, there was so much resistance, so much ostracization, exclusion, and yet we are still bound together. There is no release. There's no freedom from that. And then I go to spaces where there are schools and teachers that are so nurturing, that help me find my voice in a different way, you know, in a healthier way. You know, another a good friend of mine, Crystal Kieran, who is a Broadway star, actor extraordinaire, incredible artist, you know. It was actually a South Asian academic, I believe. I don't have the name directly on the tip of my tongue, who coined the idea of third culture. So a lot of young people, or a lot of people who are born not in their like ancestral space and living between these dual cultures and whatnot, this carving out a third culture. It was more popular, I think, in the 1890s, but it's coming back, and that's really neat. Yeah, it's this constant duality of trying to find freedom to speak, but also feel the filial piety and responsibility and duty of care. A great example is the idea of how we show affection. You know, here there is a lot of like fear of touching, obviously with like distancing and pandemics and stuff. That's a thing. But there's a lot of like verbal affection. I love you. You're sweet, my sweetheart. Whatever, right? And you know, the stereotypes are true for a reason. You know, my mother did not say I love you. I didn't get hugs, but I got a great meal. And if I was at school working or whatever till all hours, they would be there and they would never complain about it. They would just, well, they'd guilt you about it, but they would complain, right? So it's just like it's duty of care. And so we reframe those languages.
Yeah, again, you raise a good point. Affection, it's shown in such different ways in both cultures. You're correct. And I don't know if you experience this. Is your native language English? Like, do you is your first language, I guess, English or
I would say, sure, I'd say it's like it's become English, is the best way to say it. When I was born, my mother spoke to me mainly in, or probably exclusively in Cantonese. And then my father spoke to me exclusively in Vietnamese. And obviously, growing up, then there was school and it was predominantly English. And on my father's side, from where he was in Vietnam and whatnot, There was also a lot of French influence, though I really wouldn't say that French was huge in my life, but then French in school. So there were, I would say there were like four languages that were coming at me generally. And I'm not sure if this is what you're alluding to, but I will say that there is this really nuanced approach to translation. You know, I was speaking to my former head of my department and advisor, Dr. Gerd Hauch, who's a theater professor. And we were talking to him about language. And he said this really interesting thing. He said, I don't believe that we think in a language. I think that human beings think of images, and then our brain then interprets those images through that language or whatever language, right? So,
Interesting. I was gonna say it's. I'm really curious as to see, hear your point of view in this because you said you kind of had four languages thrown at you growing up. Because well, I grew up speaking Turkish. Turkish is my native language, but at this point, English is kind of becoming my first language as I keep living here. And it's not just me, it's all of my international friends that I've spoken to. We all feel the same way, which is it's easier to say affectionate things in English because that's the language we learned afterwards, even though we use it more now. And it's more difficult to say, for example, say, I love you in our native languages. It's difficult because it feels more real. And it feels like there's more tied to it than it does with English. I wonder if you have an experience like that with any of the languages you spoke growing up, and especially because you mentioned how it's more, I guess, normal in Eastern cultures to not be verbally affectionate, but show it through your actions. So if that has an effect on it too.
It's a really good question, and I think you've stumped me. What I'm trying to think about, what I'm trying to think more is, I want to challenge this a little bit. I want to challenge the idea that I don't think it's a dichotomy of like Eastern and Western, because I think like what is Western? You know, like we're influenced by so many things, right? The Greeks, the poetics, the whatever, and in Latin there are seven different terms of love, right? From like human love to emotional love and whatever, right? So I want to challenge that first off. I think that maybe what's more true for me right now, where English is not my first language, but my dominant language, is the media that we consume. You know, I binge watch Grey's Anatomy. I do. It's a thing. It is my like brain shut off release of like I can just watch this and all the dramatic mess of it all. But that's the thing we see in the media, TV, film, and theater, even like all the things, right? That's the type of relationships that we are shown the most of, and that's the and what we see how they show love is there, right? And I'll say, interestingly enough, that's the part of representation that really matters to me. So, example, Crazy Rich Asians, you know, it was a big deal, all Asian cast, whatever, right? And let's okay, I want to be very clear here. What familiarity do I have with billionaires in like Singapore? Nothing. But the relationship of how the hierarchical dynamics between like a child and a mother or auntie or whatever else, I immediately grasped that. That was like, I knew what that was. Like the making of dumplings together, the criticisms, the just like those were so familiar to me. That I'm like, oh, I feel seen. And the thing is, it's like that's what like, you know, a lot of times people talk about representation, like I need to see myself, and they think, oh, if I can see an Asian lead as a romantic lead in a film, that's fantastic. Yeah, that's one aspect of it. And people tend to like leave it there. And that's where it feels like a bit tokenistic, where oh, we've got some Asian characters, we've got that like Asian Power Ranger or whatever, right? But it's more about like, can that character, can that person embody their reality in a driven and meaningful and integral way to the story. So I think that there are challenges to how we learn to say I love you and how we learn to say it. And but there's so much more nuance, and I don't want to leave it as a dichotomy of like Western and Eastern. I think it's more culturally specific and class specific, to be honest. Like how much access do you have, right? And an ability. Yeah, I'll leave it at that. That's a big whole can of worms.
That's yeah, we could get into it.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. And I don't know how to transition from this into the
Sure. So speaking of the festival, okay. I'm so grateful for this conversation with you today. It's what I'm most grateful for is a safe place to speak. You know, I know that you read and listened to my TEDx talk, and where I recognized, acknowledged how important it was for the phrase voice for the voiceless was. And this term was used by many celebrities and people with big platforms and as a way of allyship and solidarity. But I really believe that for all the genocide and all the silencing that happens, survivors never stop speaking. We've never stopped speaking. And oftentimes, the first thing someone needs to say is a scream. I've tried really hard to resist that and focus more on, as an arts administrator, to create a platform for listening where if I can bring in different audiences, and more specifically, if I can bring in change makers, people in immediate power that could do something about this story, you know, because, you know, I think of the poetry of many young Asian American, Northwestern American poets. And I think that, you know, there's such a high turnover that they don't know the stories that came before that are the same. I think of my own stories, my own work, like, oh, I have a poem that was just like that. I'm sad that you're still writing that poem. That's a reality. Bosea has a huge poem like that. Kit Yan, Reggie Kubica has, you know. I think of so many powerful, young, growing, emerging, established Indigenous poets who is still harking the stories of E. Paul Johnson. You know, it's just like there's so much connection that doesn't change. I think of my mentor, Charity Wilson, who always acknowledges where her teachers come from. She studied with Don DePrima and then Jack Kerouac and you know, and that lineage of beat poets. So the theme for the festival for Versus 2024 is learning and remembering, learning from each other and remembering together. And so for everything we talked about today, every artist that's coming in, Lillian Allen, Marie Metaphor, Patrick Bellin, Chris C, Erin Dingle, so many amazing artists coming in, all have a deep rooted practice in education and teaching and understanding the representation of nuanced storytelling, sharing different realities. I'm so excited for a few new shows and a few old shows that are consistent, like Derek Edenshaw from Native Hip Hop Society is coming in and curating an incredible Oral Traditions. It's our annual showcase of Indigenous voices. We've been partnering and supporting with the Writers Festival with Fade to Black Entertainment, Lincoln Thorne's organization that puts on Vancouver Black Music Month, the Love Jones Slam, and the Vancouver Black Independent Film Festival. So we're doing a the Love Jones showcase, which is going to showcase so many awesome contemporary Black voices and really honoring the roots of where we know this style of contemporary spoken word, and while having many more in. And a keynote from Lillian Allen on Saturday of the festival, that where she's just speaking and performing about, you know, she's done so much work with groundings, really looking at how we first engage spoken word artists in the academic realm, but also racialized voices occupying the academy. And it's really incredible. So everything we talked about is manifested in this theme this year. Last year's theme was gathering found family back around the table because we just need to get back together. The band's gonna come back. We all gotta sit around, gotta eat some food, have a good time. Let's just do this thing. This year, it's about learning, remembering that we're together. Let's really get into it, right? And then next year's theme I'm really excited by is called Amplify. So now we've gotten together, we've talked about it. So what needs to be heard? Let's get it out there, right? So it's I've curated the next few years just to build that kind of progression. But if you're listening to this in time, please come on out to this festival. Everything is pay what you can. We have suggested prices. We're a struggling nonprofit, but we will never turn anyone away because of financial barriers. We want to do our best to make that accessible. So just go to vancouverpoetryhouse.com or any of the social platforms, and it'll link you to the events. Check it out and come on out.
That's amazing. And I absolutely love that all of the events are pay what you can. It's so important. Art has such an important place in, I feel like, everyone's life, even if they don't notice, like realize it. And not being able to, I guess, feed your soul with it just because of financial reasons is really unfortunate. And I'm glad that, you mentioned that. It's very important. And you actually have a workshop, if I'm not mistaken, right, for the festival.
I have two workshops, sort of. So what I mentioned earlier, Stage to Page is very exciting. Stage to Page is Friday at 2 p.m. We've got folks like Leo D. Johnson, Sierra Avery, Adrian Neblett, and some other musicians. Like I said earlier, poets really want to get out there. Poets who really want to branch out, they're gonna have a chance to workshop and see an artist workshopping for the first time with professional musicians. With music directors, with studio artists versus like touring artists. It's like, and to hear the words shared by and read by a trained, incredible voice and text orator, actor, it's incredible. So that's gonna be super, super powerful. Every year it's been growing. And every year, it's like everyone leaves, like, well, that was magic. That's like their favorite part of the workshop festival series. So please come out to that. And then my own workshop, I have a deep passion for teaching. I'm actually also a co-lead coach for TEDx Surrey. I was a speaker that year, and then they hired me on to do the work to help others folks. And I've worked with, I don't know, about 20 different literary organizations in my career so far. And it's always the same story of like people who identify as writers who are scared or less comfortable reading on a microphone. And so I do a lot of coaching to help them get over that or move through that in a way to get their work out there. And that's my usual workshop. And this one, embodied spoken word, embodied performance, is kind of like level two of that, where we're going to go deeper in understanding voice work, breath work, body work, somatic work to engage your body so your whole self is telling the story. And whether you memorize or not, whether you're using device or not, whatever your ability might be, it's about how you access parts of you to present and be embodied on that stage. It's gonna be a lot of fun and a lot of work. And you can just watch it, you can participate in it. Again, just email and the information's online. Just check it out and come out.
Amazing. So as a performer, I can, first of all, watching your TED Talk, I could immediately tell that you're a performer because you had such a confident stance on that stage. And the things you said, you were getting to the point, And I'm wondering if this happened with your experience in spoken word. Or have you always been good at public speaking and therefore were more comfortable experimenting with spoken word?
I think the power comes from my teachers. I've had some of the most incredible teachers in my life. Denise Norman is one of the most life-changing, prolific theater artists out there in many of our worlds, based in Toronto, Tucker. And like Darlene Spencer, Mark Cassius, just these incredible teachers who focus on somatic practice. And in this way, I'm saying that it comes from two spaces. One, from poetry. What is poetry? No matter the form, poetry is the most distilled image of a thing, an idea that needs to get out. So you learn that kind of concisity and brevity. Even, and I would be wrong to not include slam in a small sliver of that, because oftentimes you have a time limit. You have to hit what you say in that time frame. And then the last one comes from the teacher I just mentioned. When we talk about intention and connection, if you think about a monologue, and I've been monologuing for like an hour or so, even today I feel like I've talked a lot too much maybe. but when you think about a monologue or someone talking a lot, If someone's just yelling at you for an hour, would you listen to them? If someone's being mean to you and you don't know them, why would you listen, right? So with my TED Talk in particular, I was really thinking about who is my audience, what is my intention, and what do I need to do to get them to stay? You know? Because it's YouTube, it's a click away. Next person, whatever, right? And so those are kind of the streams that come through it, where the practice informed it, my life experience informed it, and then my training informed it. I don't think I'm a natural at anything in that sense. It takes a lot of work, and even then, there's good and bad days for all of us, right?
Yeah, and I think what you said applies into like not simply to YouTube or online spaces, but to having conversations and maybe some discussions in person as well. Because if the person you're well talking with doesn't, I guess, really listen to what you're saying, you I guess need to question why they're not listening to you. And if you can maybe make yourself heard in a different way. And I think that's a really good point. Well, is there anything you want to mention or talk about before we leave?
First off, thank you so much for the space today. I'm really grateful for that. The only thing that I really haven't mentioned too much is big thanks to all of our partners who made Versus possible. Of course, all the funders like the Canada Council, BC Arts Council, Heritage Gaming, and a lot of foundations like Jamil Foundation and whatnot. But also are so many. I've been so lucky. So in this opportunity right now, I want to say thank you to all the staff, volunteers, and partners from like the Historic Jokogawa House to Odd Meridian. Big thanks to the Writers Festival for helping us to have space for our youth programming, which is our All-Star Slam is going to be a huge, amazing show. And that's at Performance Works on Granville Island. Then our incredible friends at the Vancouver Film School who have donated space for all of our youth programming, the competition, the workshops and whatnot there. And then really in line with learning and remembering, this really goes out to, you know, the poets who are listening to this, if they listen to it on Saturday, the closing of the festival, we've got a town hall, a national dialogue around spoken word. But then we go into this incredible keynote by the legendary, iconic Lillian Allen. So I'm really hoping that a lot of folks come and listen to, you know, her teaching for that time. And right after, we've got a showcase from Right Bloody North, another one of our dear partners and friends and supporters, featuring a lot of Right Bloody North poets. So Right Bloody North is a publishing house that really publishes spoken word artists. And there's incredible ones like Marie Metaphor and Sherady Wilson and folks. So yeah, it's really worth the time to check out the event. So please come out to everything, and we'll see you at the festival.
Definitely. That's really, it all sounds very interesting. And I mean, yeah, I'm definitely looking into all of the events,
Yeah,
seeing what
great.
I can attend. Yeah. Well, again, thank you so much for joining me, and I hope the festival is goes smoothly and well, and everyone gets what they want from, yeah, the different events.
Thanks so much.